I do hold evidences, as many people do, throughout this planet. And I don't say that I hold more than the other individual, nor less. I hold evidences that indicate to mankind, on a whole, if properly submitted, that we do have an interplanetary intelligence visiting the Earth aboard craft commonly called a flying saucer, or a cigar-shaped craft, and there are many other shapes involved, but commonly termed a flying saucer. We have evidences indicating this to be a fact, and that there are strange craft in our atmosphere that are interplanetary machines. Now, this is physical. This is physical. I'm not speaking of any metaphysical or, shall we say, the Netherland data that has been brought into the subject inadvertently by some and by on purpose by others. I'm not speaking of that at all. We can discuss that a little later this evening because we have evidences in this direction, too. The point is this, that we do have a physical, tangible craft that is visiting this Earth. And I'm going to tell now, which is something I don't normally do, is tell of my own experiences in my field.
Just one moment. I notice you employed the word A. Is it just one single craft, or are you of the belief that there are many?
There are many.
Many.
Very many. Oh, very many. And I've only been involved in my particular sightings as such and experiences. I have only been involved in a few of the types. I have not seen all of them. But I am willing to accept from the evidence that's submitted, I'm willing to accept that if I have seen a Model A Ford going down the street after having arrived upon this planet, shall we say, I see a Model A Ford going down the street, that I'm willing to accept the fact that there must be several other models around too besides Model A Ford. It's quite obvious. Because I haven't seen the craft the other man has seen, I'm not going to reject his tale. Nor am I going to reject the validity of his sighting. However, the sightings that I have made, many of them, rather astounding. It shocked me into the belief, rather than, shall we say, just a guesstimate of what was going on. My guesses were pretty good way back in 1950. I felt that what I had uncovered at that time was very good, but I hadn't enough proof to even carry it before the public. I've been working on it for a number of years before then, but I remained rather quiet. And I felt that I didn't have enough evidence. I had a belief, and I had a feeling that something was going on, but I couldn't tell to other people of my beliefs. I could only express this when I had proof. When these experiences amplify themselves through the years, and then you become involved with seeing the same thing that the man that you are investigating is seeing, it gives you this experience of being able to smell whether the man is, and I use the term smell, it's a terminology, you're able to smell out the fraud and the phony. We have a lot of them in the field. It can't be helped. An ethical topic, an ethical series of events that is going on today are bound to draw everything. The bottom of the bucket is bound to come in and clutter up the field with their bits of information, as it were. It makes it difficult for it. Very difficult. However, one of the outstanding sightings that I recall very vividly. And as I said before, I want everybody to understand that I do not normally, even in some very dire circumstances where I have to defend myself, I don't express my own personal experiences in the field. You lose the sight of being a reporter when you do. And when you're trying to investigate the other man and you're trying to compile a lot of other data, it's very difficult for a man to look at his own experiences other than just experiences. However, I'm going to tell you one tonight. I want all of you to make notes on this if you wish, because there's some very important things and it's going to bring a lot of questions up in your mind. So these questions will all be answered in a very few moments when I, express what I have seen. And if you listen to it intently, you will understand what I have seen. And it won't
create a whole lot of questions if you listen. But if you don't listen, you're going to have a whole lot of questions that are really irrelevant. I was driving to a flying saucer convention on the West Coast. Max Miller had put over a flying saucer convention, the very first one in the field, and at the Hollywood Hotel. And I had wanted to get to this convention, probably I would have gone on all fours. I couldn't afford it like every one of the other saucer researchers. It's very difficult to keep up with the expenses involved in this thing. But I was going to make the West Coast and that convention if it hurt. And I had headed out there 3 days prior to the convention. And I'm rather interested in such things as the history of man, the antiquities of man. I love such places as the cliff dwellings, the Grand Canyon area, and then, of course, the crater out there, Winslow, Arizona. I had been there before, but my boy hadn't seen it. So we spent all of one day going through the crater, talking to Dr. Nininger, whom I know, incidentally, for anybody that wants to study a little bit about meteors and meteorites. Get a hold of Dr. Miniature's books. They're very good. And the man is very objective in what he is doing. He, incidentally, is wondering why he can't see flying saucers, because he's doing a lot of observing. He thinks you have to be some sort of a specialized individual to see them. But anyhow, I spent a lot of time with Dr. Miniature. I introduced my son to him. My son is quite interested in astronomy and a lot of related subjects, and not particularly interested in saucers, I might say, even though his dad is. And we spent a few hours around there, and then we killed a lot of time in Flagstaff, Arizona, the old cliff dwellings. There are a rather interesting set of cliff dwellings there. These have always intrigued me. And after spending a lot of time around there, we took off. I'd say about 10:30 at night, we get down to Needles. And Needles was awful hot. It was really hot. And I won't give it to you in temperature. All I can say is it was extremely uncomfortable. And I have sailed aboard ships in the early days at 130, 140 degrees temperature down in an engine room. And that was really hot. So when I say it was really hot out there at Needles, I mean it. I really felt it. We left Needles, California after gassing up, and I wanted to throw the bedroll out on the desert. I decided it was too hot to do so here with all these desert winds blowing in and prevailing easterly, and as they cushioned into the foot of the mountains there, it was just stirring around with heat. My boy fell asleep on the front seat of the car, and I started to drive westward to get into the high desert country toward Barstow. And I thought, I can't make the first night of the Flying Saucer Convention, but who gives a darn? There's two other nights to go. So I'll get into L.A. when I feel like it, rather than try to get through the night. As early as the morning, it wasn't night anymore, it was the next morning. It was around 1:30 to 2 o'clock when we headed out across the desert. And I'd say we were out of town about 20 minutes west of Needles, California. And I had the funniest, itchiest sensation that something was following my car. Now, of course, some of the people in flying saucer research will say, ha-ha, these are ESP contact, a telepathic contact. This, I don't say that it took place. It couldn't possibly have been an ESP contact as such on my part, because I did not pick it up in that manner, but I had this funny hunch that we had something following my car. And I was extremely alert, looking around throughout the sky, left and right and overhead, even throwing my head out, because this is beautiful country for sighting. You can see that star coverage is just like a blanket over you out there. And it's pretty hard to pick anything out, but if there was anything at all that moved up there that was not normal to what we're accustomed to seeing at the moment, why, you would know it very quickly. So I'm very nervous and jittery, looking around, jerking around, just like the bird looking for the prey. Actually, I probably was a prey at the moment. And looking behind the car, there was an elongated cloud, dark mass. And this persisted through a period of about 15 to 20 minutes. Yet I was really sick about it, because It took me 15 minutes to wake up to the fact that here was a cloudless sky and a desert. What was an elongated cloud doing there by? I mean, I'm traveling 80 and 90 miles an hour, and there was a prevailing easterly wind. What the devil was a cloud doing there clinging to that close to the car? And suddenly, when the minute that I admitted this to myself, that this was something unusual and a little different, and I took a rapid scan, and as my eyes swung that way, there was a burst of light. It was just like, well, it was frightening, for the simple reason that when this light burst, as it did, in my eyes, I felt that, my God, there's a ship landing on the desert, and there's a distress landing here, and his landing lights have flashed on right over my car. So they hit me. This is a strange feeling that you get, this reaction. But it was a tremendous burst of light. And in this burst of light, suddenly, as my eyes, and I jerked to attention to what it was, and my eyes accustomed to it, and I want you to understand it was all momentarily. It wasn't something that would take 15 to 20 minutes. Used 15 to 20 minutes, as I was saying, to get an adjustment there. It was fractional. And there was a large cigar-shaped craft. The elongated clouds that I saw, the dark mass, is the only thing I could suspect it as being, because it wasn't there anymore. And here was this beautiful, bright, bluish-white light and cigar-shaped. And now I'm going to give the so-called researchers or enthusiasts of flying saucers a shock. This particular craft was the blunt-ended Adamski mother-type ship out there beyond my car, traveling in the same direction. And I'm doing, as I said, about 90 to 95, going west. And there was this craft out there glowing. The blunt ends on it. Cold, hard, solid lines of a vehicle. Not an etherical substance, but a good, clear, hard vehicle. And blunted on both ends. Not conducive to space travel or aerodynamic travel as we know it. And in this flash, like the drowning man, because this is all in seconds, that how long he paused there. For my benefit, I'm sure, is that he paused right in the line of my vision. And not a porthole in it, not a thing on this craft, but just beautiful, cylindrical in shape. And I used the term beautiful because it was. You could feel there was something about a craft of that type hovering out there over the desert without a projection on it, not a wing on it, nothing, and not a sound. And yet this glow, it lit up the desert far brighter than the lightning, and yet it had a lightning-like quality, the bluish-white light. And I would judge, this is only a guess, I would judge this thing to have been approximately a half a mile away from my car and approximately a half a mile in altitude. And it filled two-thirds of my two-door old 88 coach door. That is the two doors, the larger door, and it isn't the four door, the narrow window. So for those of you that are driving cars with narrow window doors, you are going to think of a smaller craft than what I have in mind. But for those of you that drive with larger windowed automobiles, two-thirds of that left window of my car was filled with this beautiful picture. It was awe-inspiring to see a craft of this nature hovering over there, over the desert, literally hovering over there, and in a few seconds that I got this eyeful, and then he moved off. And as he moved off, he didn't disappear like some people say, oh, he disappeared. You're going to say that immediately. Those with the occult interpretation are going to say, oh, he disappeared. It was a metaphysical something. It just vanished, mat and demat, materialization and dematerialization. People quickly jumped to this conclusion. It was not. He moved off rapidly. And in fact, 4.5 seconds from the time that he started to move, he moved with a gradual increase in speed. He just didn't dart out. But in 4.5 seconds, he was nothing but a bright star to the west. Another very bright star. And I watched that, and as you well know, that you would watch something like that, all eyes. I'm trying to pinch my boy and
gospel up rim over their heads while he was on the seat to wake him up to see the sighting of the ages, in my estimation. And now, my personal opinion on this has always been that I prefer the cigar-shaped craft as a sighting. I don't know why, I just have. Maybe it's because I have been in the field of rocketry and aircraft for so many years that I feel that the cigar-shaped craft is more conducive to man's efforts in this direction. Maybe so. However, it was the one cigar-shaped craft that I had seen that was really astounding, and nobody can tell me that this was an earthly vehicle. Nobody can tell me that this was not something built other than on this planet. Where, I don't know. I haven't the slightest guess where he came from or how many people were aboard. I do feel, though, that there were intelligences aboard that craft. This is something that you would say was just strictly hunch. And it is. I have no proof that there were any intelligences on there other than my own particular hunch that here is a craft. And if these people, as such, or intelligences as such, were to utilize a craft of this type, if they were etherical in nature, what in the world do they need a craft of that type for? Well, they could use an etherical means of travel. What do they need a craft of that type for? And they sure didn't build that craft for my specific benefit. This I am very sure of. They didn't build that for my benefit, nor did it some, shall we say, prankster give me some optical illusion of some sort. This was very real. Now, there wasn't a sound of this craft when it moved off. It led me to believe that it is not utilizing normal propulsion means. It is physically impossible for you or I to decide what the size of any craft is unless we know it beforehand, other than having a fix on it from the two different positions and then matching their notes. However, in this particular case, I would say that this craft was, intuitively, is all I can give you an answer on, and this, intuitively, I would say that this was at least 4.5 times the size of the Queen Mary. This was the very least it could have been. It could have been larger. But I don't know its exact distance from me, nor do I know its exact altitude. I don't know any of these factors, and I have nothing to relate it to at all. So I can say that intuitively I would guess it to be, and my guess can be very wrong, but I would say that it was not any smaller, in guessing, than 4.5 times the size of the Queen Mary. That'd be about a mile long, then, I'm not sure. This would be roughly a mile long. Well, filling your windshield, not the windshield, filling the side door of the car, two-thirds of that, will give you the immensity of this craft. It was far beyond anything that I felt could be ever built on this earth, let alone getting into the air. A picture without a projection. Go ahead, you have something to say, Long John?
Well, a couple of questions. You said something about 4.5 seconds.
Yeah, it was just
an approximate.
4 to 5 seconds ago.
It was an inversion there, but I say you could spread it.
Now, it seems to me that you mentioned that there was a meeting of the Flying Saucers International, that you hoped that you and your son could at least be able to get 2 days of the convention.
Mm-hmm.
You said you were not going to force it to drive there to catch the first day. I'm just thinking of questions that I feel that many of the people on the party line would like to present if they had the opportunity that I have tonight to
interview you.
By all means. Do you feel that due to the length of this trip, it wasn't a very long trip,
not for me, actually. I just come back from Alaska. I just covered an Alaskan trip.
Well, I'm talking about the amount of mileage that you were trying to make in a day.
You were driving from Chicago?
Yeah, I was driving from Chicago to L.A. at the time.
About 2,300 miles.
Yeah, about 2,300 miles. Do you think there's a possibility, John, that you were tired and that this may have been a hallucination?
Well, that's a very good question. It's coming from you. I rather question its intent, because do I look tired now?
No, not a bit.
I've been up all night.
I've been up all night for 3 nights. This again brings up the problem. I'm going to ask you a question. Please, I'm not evading you, but I wasn't going to bring up the problem of understanding one man and another. I can stay up for a week without any sleep and get away with it and still be wide awake.
Another man would have made that statement because
another man, WOR, may be looking for a fellow to do this.
Another man can stay up for 15 minutes beyond his bedtime, and he's a collapsed individual. And I believe that's what you were trying to express. Was I in a collapsed condition? In other words, could I have been under a state of hallucination? I would say most definitely not. In my estimation, however, I know that there are psychiatrists about that would say, ha, 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 this is meat for the fire. This boy was really tired. I have driven to California, quoting, I have driven to California, and I know you can get awful, awful tired, and you can see a lot of strange things in the desert. Brought up last night, I believe, a man talking, what was it the night before, when you had this young Ellison on, talking about how many
Harlan Ellison,
young Harlan Ellison. Oh, I would have loved to have been here that night. I tried to call you. Why didn't you open up your telephone and for that?
I wasn't here.
You weren't here. You were in New York, but open up the telephone and
allow to.
Well, you should. There's a guy on the West Coast that does this. Ben Hunter has a program much like yourself. And incidentally, we must talk about him because there was a very exciting face message contact arrangement made over that broadcast, and I want to tell the audience about it. But Ben has his telephone open. And at the specific hours of the morning, and the audience call in, and many of them call long distance, and those that are on the preferred list, they call collect, and this fellow does a terrific job on the same subjects that you do.
Well, we find that if we take phone calls, as an example, if I picked up the phones here now, we wouldn't have an interview.
Well, that's true, but I mean, I want to express this, that he does have interviews much like you do, and then again, he has interviews with the telephone callers. Consequently, he's always got the live program of getting new material at all times over that telephone. He doesn't have to wait for them to come in, and when they come in, that makes it even better, because then he can talk a little longer with them. But he holds 15, 20-minute conversations over the phone, and people speak of subjects on religion and occult interpretations of various things in medicine and fosters, and he goes on there all from 1 to 5 every morning, the same as you do. And these are invaluable and important.
Well, we have tried that from time to time, and we find that the person making the call is very much interested in the conversation, but the people on the party line want to get back to listening to John Otto and Cortland Hastings.
That's a good point.
Well, we'll drop that tired bit for a moment. I'm just wondering, I've heard this statement used time and time again, and I think that you sort of incorporated it, not just word for word, and that is, you have to believe to see, and I'm of the nature that I want to see before I believe.
I'm not entirely in accord with that statement. Did I cut you too short?
Yes, in other words, what about him? And I gave you two statements.
Well, the one,
must you believe to see, or can you see to and then believe?
I would say that, to answer that I haven't found that to be the case entirely. I have found that the people that have absolutely no concept of what's going on in this ethical topic at all have seen. And that probably had the more astounding of sightings. Those people that haven't the slightest concept. Now, to find out whether these people, in their a way of living, are any different than the others, I have never found any evidence indicating this at all. But I found people that haven't had the slightest concept to go along with this, haven't had the slightest experience at all, haven't even been, shall we say, exposed to a newspaper article on the subject, and this you'll say was pretty hard.
That's very difficult.
But it is, because it seems that way. But then again, a lot of people wouldn't even notice that. Their eyes would go right through a newspaper, never even see a flying saucer report. And what's that? They wouldn't even think of it. And yet, some of these people have been subject, and this time going back to the earlier days of saucers, that the terminology was, well, hindsight. This was used a lot in occult interpretations, incidentally. The hindsight of man. The just the flash looking here in
in a direction for no reason at all and suddenly seeing something. Well, these people haven't had what you could call a belief, and yet they saw. So I wouldn't say that this is so. I wouldn't say that you had to believe to see.
Are you a resident of California?
I will be very shortly. I'm a resident of Chicago, Illinois at the present time, because I have made I'm making a permanent move to the West Coast, and in doing so, I'm still a resident of Chicago, though.
Flying Saucers International, a metaphysical group?
Most definitely not. Some people have stated that from time to time, and I'm showing you at this moment a bulletin that is turned out quarterly by Max Miller of Flying Saucers International. It's called Saucers. And there are some very interesting little bits on the flying saucer research as such that are submitted from time to time. I would like to say that Max Miller is in liaison with a lot of very interesting people in and on our planet. And this man has a reputation that is rather outstanding. People respect his evaluating ability. They respect him to the extent that he is given confidential information from time to time. I'm not trying to lead you to believe that you'll find confidential information published in his bulletin that you won't find elsewhere, but I would like to tell you that he comes up with many firsts in the field. Many firsts. Many people have thought, though, that all flying saucer researchers or enthusiasts are of occult leanings. And this is far from the truth. However, I have found in my particular investigation that many people that are interested in the topic eventually start investigating the occult or start investigating the metaphysical interpretation. This, I think, is a natural. You should. But I do not believe, and I believe this is what CSI was trying to express, and I didn't wish to be trite or smart at the time when I said it, but I do believe that this organization was trying to express, in their opinion, they didn't feel that occult interpretation should be considered flying saucers, and in this I thoroughly agree. That occult, as such, as a research, I do believe that occult research is a very valid and a very real topic of discussion, of investigation, and I think that men should know about it. I think all men that are ready should know about it. But I do not believe that it is healthy for people to say that you must have occult knowledge to understand flying saucers, and I don't believe it has any part of the flying saucer subject.